We are taking your calls, your messages, your thoughts on President Cyril Ramaphosa's announcement, a level-based approach over to be implemented over the next few weeks and months. For now, we are still in level 5, the most stringent of the levels. Full lockdown still continues, but from the 1st of May, we will be downgraded to level 4, which means that many of us will still have to be at home, practice social and physical distancing, but key parts of the economy and industrial sector will be open. Angelo Fick is a political analyst giving us his take on the president's announcement. Angelo, people have been tired and people have been put through a lot. Yes, there is a global public health emergency, but people tend to be inward looking. And in this studio, and I'm sure on my timelines and people at home, we're clearly looking out for issues of, is lockdown going to be ended? Would they be able to buy cigarettes, alcohol, and would they be able to go for a jog? Everything else was just sort of white noise in the background, wasn't it?
Well, that may be the case for some people, and it's a very middle-class approach, I think, that a very small minority of South Africans can afford to have, to think about jogging and walking your dog and getting alcohol and cigarettes. I think for many South Africans, this is at least a glimpse of the process that we are engaged in the months ahead. So the scaling down to level 4 is, I think, an important signal to South Africans that the measures that were implemented over the last 5 weeks, in which the World Health Organization praised yesterday as a very good measure compared to some other situations, was made basically to prepare us, as the Premier of the Western Cape just indicated, for the health challenges that are going to come our way in midwinter. So the healthcare systems and individuals, PPE needs to be in place, medicine, beds, etc. So this has been a preparatory phase. But I think as important as the scaling back is, it is also important for us to remind ourselves that, as the Premier has indicated, as various epidemiologists, including Professor Salim Abdul Karim, has indicated, that there are hard times ahead that we need to prepare ourselves for, and not just economically, but also actually at the level of mental health challenges, because in a society where thousands of people are dying, you know, it is going to be a very, very difficult time for us to go through, and we need to begin to build up resilience, not only individually, but as societies, as groups, as neighborhoods, because there are tough times ahead.
But as we've seen over the last few weeks, and people that I've spoken to across all level of economic strata, essentially with the attitude of, oh, because I can't see it, because I don't necessarily know someone who is infected, I don't know anyone close to me who has the disease, I only see it on TV, therefore if I can't see it, it can't see me approach. And when you put people like that under 3, 4, 5 weeks of lockdown, they start to rebel. And this is what I am seeing anecdotally on my way driving here to the studio. The first, second, third week, there was almost zero cars that I would encounter on the R27 driving to this office. This evening, it was as if it was just post peak traffic on a Thursday evening.
And that, I think, is an explicable, if intolerable, situation. So one can explain that behavior as the magical thinking that if it isn't happening right now, it isn't going to happen. We know that the epidemiologists have pointed out that there is a lag from infection to actual showing of disease, from disease symptoms to actually getting ill, and from getting ill into either recovery or the other much less pleasant option. And I also think that for many people, this is an idea that, oh, I'm not going to be one of the 6% of people who are going to be negatively or, you know, horribly affected by this disease and could possibly die. I'm going to be in the 80% of people who have mild symptoms. And as various epidemiologists have pointed out, that we don't really know enough about the disease yet, because there are several exceptions to that rule. And then we, I think, tend to forget that we're actually in the early phase of this particular outbreak in South Africa. And so it may look like nothing is going to happen here the way in which it happened somewhere else, for which there is a long history of South African exceptionalism. But one doesn't want to get to the point where you do know the people, you know, next door who died, or you know that your mother died, or that someone, you know, who was a nurse to your mother died. So these kinds of stories that we're seeing are familiar to people who looked at the first phases of the Italian outbreak, the Spanish outbreak, that there was a kind of magical thinking that it's going to happen to somebody else. And I think it is unreasonable to expect of people to make a sea change in their heads very quickly and realize that actually it's not going to happen to somebody else, it's going to happen to all of us. South Africa is not going to be exceptional, and nothing that we can do is going to make us exceptional to the kinds of consequences of this COVID outbreak. Mm-hmm. And so I can understand the magical thinking, I can understand the defiance, but you know, part of me is also, you know, quite rational and asking whether this is not also the consequence of very bad science education, a very poor understanding of the germ theory of disease, and not just among the poor and the so-called uneducated, but among some of the most formally highly educated people that we have. The assumption that, you know, it's going to be like flu. Virulence, as it is defined in this case, in this the case for this disease by the epidemiologists, ought to concern people that this spreads much more easily and quickly, and that the, you know, percentages might sound low, but if even 3% of people who get ill die in a society, 3% of 60% of 58 million people would cause an absolute, you know, tear in the social fabric that I don't think any of us are prepared for. If we want to see locally where that has happened, examples include the Midlands massacres of the mid-1990s in KwaZulu-Natal, and then the AIDS pandemic's cost when we didn't roll out ARVs. Entire families in which, you know, all the adults basically died. In this case, the elderly would die, the ill would die, and what you would then sit with is people who have to do the grieving in the morning. And if you imagine that you can have a productive economy and an ordinary life that continues in the wake of that kind of trauma, I think that is truly magical thinking. So one doesn't want to be alarmist, but one wants to caution people about looking around them and thinking that, oh, well, we got through the first 5 weeks, so it's all going to be hunky-dory. Nothing about what the epidemiologists are telling us indicate that we are anywhere near where we're going to be in July and August.
I'm not advocating for the complete opening of the economy and just letting people run wild. But as you said, people may not have an understanding of the science. But for the underemployed man who I spoke to in the week, he understands basic economics of that. I need to find money, I need to find an income so I can put food on my table. And this is a direct quote, which I was quite shocked by. I would rather take my chances with a virus than take my chances against hunger. So is there then this imbalance between people not understanding the medical, the scientific danger compared to the economic reality that stares them in the face?
So part of the problem we sit with in South Africa is that we're a society of great inequality. And if we were a more equal society, much of what we see as the consequences of this particular crisis would actually be mitigated. So what we're now having to deal with is a multiple range of issues that have arisen, not just ahead of the crisis, but partly because of the crisis. So if you lock down the economy in a more equal society, it is possible to distribute food, distribute care packages, and think of wage loss mitigating mechanisms. In a country like South Africa with huge unemployment, as we saw, it isn't enough to simply do unemployment insurance payments to the workforce that is now made unemployed. You then sit with millions of people who've never had a job, who are unemployed, people in the informal economy who aren't registered, and so you need to roll that out. So that rollout has now happened from government side. But that's not nearly enough. It now requires that those of us who have to reach out and into our pockets and into our pantries and begin to contribute to the alleviation of the crisis around food, food security, water security, and nutritional insecurity. It doesn't help when people think that if you simply remove the hungry people and the poor people from your own neighborhood, the problem is going to go away. Mm-hmm. That problem isn't going to go away. This is really a situation that is both transnational and trans, you know, neighborhood. The disease is no longer contained by borders. So closing your border mitigates some of your having to respond, but eventually you have to participate in the global international trade for basic services and goods. And the same thing with neighborhoods. If people imagine that it's going to be a crisis somewhere in the poor neighborhoods and not in the middle-class neighborhoods, they forget that despite the continuation of the spatial dynamics of colonialism and apartheid that separates black and white, rich and poor to a large extent in our cities, people move because they're people who don't do their own labor. And it turns out that those of us in the middle classes imported the disease and gave it to other people, which is why it's now in supermarkets. And so people who are doing the very basic services to keep our lives going are at the highest risk of exposure. We've seen this in the United Kingdom, where the people who die are not just healthcare workers in those ICU units. They're bus drivers. They're people who are doing very basic work in order to facilitate food on the table, as your, you know, interviewee or respondent told you. And that, I think, is highly unfair. It should never be the case that somebody should have to make a choice between risking their life in order to feed their family, or going hungry. The kind of cruel world that we have built over the last few generations is one that we now have, as Arundhati Roy has pointed out, a portal into unmaking. And the unmaking must begin now. We cannot wait for this crisis to end and then think of building a world that's different. The world that we built brought us to this crisis, and we need to get out of this crisis by, in process, in dealing with the crisis, building a new world. And so, yes, it is appalling that that man has to make that kind of individual choice. But we who have and have access to resources, and not just the food and the money, but the access to resources through NGO networks, through faith-based networks, through community networks, we need to make it possible for him not to have to face that choice. And that means some very hard networking, some very, very tough agitation of government at local, provincial, and at national level. We made the state. We should use the mechanisms of the state to make sure that the ugliness that this could result in is mitigated, and people don't have to make these kinds of terrible Sophie's choices between possibly dying or leaving their family to go hungry.
What does it say about the way that we have responded to this, whether how the media has responded to this, how our social media responds to this? Does it hold up a mirror to when the conversation over the last few weeks has not necessarily been about a public health crisis? Yes, this formed the background and the context, but we've been talking about garage pies, Woolworths chicken, where we can buy pineapples and yeast to make our own beer, where we can source cigarettes and alcohol. What does that say about the way we as a population, particularly middle-class population, who has access to the social media and online news and things like that, that we've responded to this outbreak talking about those frivolities?
So I think those frivolous elements are basically people, again, you know, acting out. We all have to, at some point, express our anxieties and deal with them in particular ways. And so the agitation for rotisserie chicken for me was a symptom of people's ability or struggle to cope with the psychological anxieties that result from isolation and an interruption to their patterns of living, patterns that we have all become addicted to. I don't necessarily want to pathologize those kinds of reactions, because we all take them in different ways. I take obsessive pictures of my books. I obsessively read novels I used to read in times more quiet and reread them. So, you know, to me, we have different ways of coping with this. My question is, what in addition to those silly, foolish, sometimes quite entitled ways of behaving are we doing? And that, I think, is part of the measure of our ability to remain human in this. Are we exercising empathy? Are we using our, you know, legal access to networks, to politicians, to try and mitigate the consequences for people who are not like us, who don't sit in 144 square meter homes or apartments, who don't have access to delivery services or food parcels from supermarkets? What is it that we're doing in addition to our ordinary lives? Because that is precisely the beginning of unmaking old ways of being and beginning to work on new ways of being. Because there's a brave new world out there that we all are going to have to reemerge into. And that world will either visit its depredations on us, and or we will have to make sure that the structures are in place for that not to happen. And so I don't want to demonize people who are, you know, that are agitating for rotisserie chicken or sharing recipes on how to bake without yeast. Those are natural, odd reactions that we all have to a moment of crisis. The question is, what in addition to that are we doing? And I think in that sense, many South Africans have shown themselves more than capable of doing it. I mean, I left a WhatsApp group of 250 people because it got too much for me, in which people were spending 14 to 16 hours of every day agitating for getting resources, channeling resources, and that included food, water, health services, help for the battered and abused spouses, women, children, police depredations being reported, a variety of actions that, you know, sort of are necessary for people to do because they have access to data, they have access to mobile phones, they can make the telephone calls, they have the law degrees, they can do what is necessary. And that, I think, has been a great source of hope for me, that not that even when I get tired, somebody else will be doing things to reinvigorate me so that I can take a week off from the engagement, because it is incredibly psychologically and spiritually taxing, and reemerge hopefully at some point to reengage and relieve somebody else of the work that they have to do. And in that sense, ordinary South Africans across various class divisions have agitated and worked together. People from Rosebank in Cape Town working with people in Bontheville, people in Bontheville working with people in Delft, people in Delft agitating with people sitting in Durbanville. And those have been very, very, shall we say, energizing observations and scenes to see. So not everybody has been selfish. We all have our selfish moments, if not demonize those, because it's a natural human reaction. But we're all struggling to come to terms with what this new world is going to look like in October of 2021 or of 2024. And it's understandable that people are going to struggle. The question is, what else are we allowing ourselves to do, learn from, and engage with others?
Angelo Fick, political analyst. Thank you so much. A pleasure as always.